from the order.
Can I motion for number 486?
Second.
All right, so we're here to go over the IS policy. I'm going to turn it over to
no attendance.
So we've made some significant revisions to, as you can tell from the previous submission. We had some input from our from Sadara, our chief, our virtual chief information security office, to really kind of go through this from with a kind of really neutral set of eyes, and made some significant recommendations. Some of that is really pulling out what is considered kind of procedure versus something that might be considered more of a more policy. And so they give us the flexibility to look when procedures change or technology changes that supports the policy, we can kind of tweak the standard operating procedures accordingly without having to really continue to make significant changes to the policy. So with that, we pulled out a number of standard operating procedures around security policies, use procedures, management procedures, operational procedures, and technical procedures. Which basically, essentially support the policy. So I mean, I think with that, those recommendations, some of our surgical editing, we reduced this from about 86 pages or so to something a little bit
43 pages
less cumbersome. Right. Yeah. It addresses a lot of. I think it's really comprehensive, even though it's in its current state. It's very comprehensive. It's very contemporary. It gives us enough flexibility for when technology changes, we can adapt, and we could adapt our procedures behind the scenes without having to actually change the policy significantly. And we also have a boilerplate, or more. We now have a template that, if we need to modify the policy, we're going off of a standard or set of standards developed by the National Institutes of Science and Technology. So that gives us some flexibility, yet it conforms to some standards that allow us, again, to kind of navigate the space when, if and when the landscape changes.
I didn't know, so we took the document and created the executive summary, and I didn't know if you, what is the best way for us to go through a 40-something page document? Is it
line by line? But yeah, I was gonna say line by line. Brian and I are on the same page.
Okay, so I mean, the overview exists within here. I don't know that I have
Who's DR? These comments.
Don Redmond. He's our virtual chief information security officer that was brought on early this year. There, he's from Sadara.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. You're saying he's virtual, meaning.
ChatGPT's cousin. Yeah.
He's an actual person, right?
He's an actual person that doesn't exist in
doesn't physically reside in Ulster County, but he's an employee of Sadara, and they have a chief information security office that they kind of farm out to other municipalities and other entities as well.
We may be looking to internalize the role as a part of implementation of this policy, though, in the budget.
Okay, may I ask? Just a general follow-on question to Don. What did you say his last name?
Redmond.
So I see a lot of comments from him, and a few of them are, just, this is great, but a bunch of them have suggestions. Are you planning, what are we planning, and I appreciate seeing them, I just want to say, but what are we planning on doing with the suggestions?
So, for example, there's one suggestion. This is just as an example. There was one suggestion about where can I find it? Has to do with our retention policies. Mm-hmm. So, email retention. So, I think it's page 26 of 22.18. So,
26, you say?
Yeah, page 26. Just as an example, is this a where does this retention policy come from? So as a department, we operate on the assumption that we don't get rid of anything, right? Our email goes back in time when we first stood up Office 365. Hmm.
Policy, yeah.
So is this retention something that was just arbitrarily decided, or is this something that's been standardized? Does the county need to preserve certain records? Like, where does that retention
depends? Some of the some emails.
But I think the point about this is that if that's the case, we can reference it here, right?
Right. Some emails will act as official records in terms of approvals and performing financial transactions, so your retention is longer. So it's not just a blanket email thing. If it affects or if it's decision-making, if it's part of a process, if we're using the email system for that, it's got its own retention schedule depending on the topic.
Who decides that? Who's going to scour the topics? You got AI set up for that? Because how many emails a day you got?
I mean, to be honest, it's
we don't get rid of anything, so have discovery techniques and technology.
Everything is currently retained, so there is no schedule applied for destruction.
Okay, so I recall, and I'm going to have to, I believe it was sent over to you all, but if it wasn't, when we had the work done, well, we being the legislative side of the house, had the work done and had that advisor, whose name is escaping me right now,
Eisner-Anthner,
thank you, do the information technology and information security analysis, I am recalling that there were very specific recommendations with regard to retention, and I am recalling that I was resistant to them because I like the idea of keeping things forever, and they were pretty adamant that you not keep things forever, that you have that there's a schedule for removal,
yes,
and it's X number of years, whatever the years is, and goodbye. So I think that we want to get some of these things, I know this is not the final meeting, but I think we want to get some of these things ironed out, right?
Like in terms of a retention schedule? I mean, so SED publishes the state retention.
Yeah, I'm saying not just in terms of a retention schedule. It's like the comments that I see are Don Redman's, and I don't know if the comptroller has commented on the updated. The comptroller had extensive comments on the previous, but just that if there are points of inflection or questions throughout the document, which I didn't say it, but I appreciate the substantial changes that were made, the work that was done, making it Ulster County, removing all the things that were in Ulster County, making it more accessible and understandable, removing what you talked about, procedure, I think is smart because you want it to be a living document, you want it to speak to policy and the procedure to be flexible. But I also think now is like the work of actually drilling down to some of these things, which are policy discussions, but that's a big one. It just happens that you picked one as an example that is kind of a big issue.
Right, and the reason why I bring that up is because it's the kind of thing like if we reference some sort of retention policy, does it reside outside of this so that we don't have to update this?
Yes.
We refer to the retention policy so that when the retention policy changes, we don't update this, right? So I think that's the key here is that there's certain sections where we...
Do we have a retention policy? That's what I'm at. I mean, I guess that's...
We're subject to the state's retention policy that's specific to counties and other organizations.
So that's where he's suggesting that we reference that here.
Yeah.
Like if we put it in the, in the appendix somehow, or we reference it somewhere so that it's clear to all engaged.
So getting to the crux of probably what you're asking is, are we implementing this retention policy?
Right, that's what I'm saying.
No.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
Everything's
like
preserved right now, so nothing is being filtered and deleted. And
right. And again, there may be an argument. Like, the base of me likes preservation, but I'm saying that it feels pretty clear to me that not just Eisner-Anthner, but It's a industry kind of standard in the public and the private sector to only hold things for a certain amount of time, similar to your personal tax records.
Yes,
after
100%
they go out.
Agree, and think that we should be applying this not just in paper but also to the digital records. Yes.
Yeah, and I feel very differently about records of the legislature and their proceedings. Like that's something that I feel like makes more sense for historical records and being able to look back over time. But when we're talking about millions of emails, it just seems a little overbearing. So I guess what I'm saying is we need to drill down into some of those things, but we also need to make sure that if we're referencing policies that they exist, that if we're referencing that if we want to have and that further that it's probably a time to look at whether or not we're following those policies.
Okay.
And probably this is the intersection of the two sides of government. If it's enough to just reference the state policy and say that's enough, or if we want to, and we may say no, we want to have a county policy that goes a little deeper or that tweaks that in this or that way, and in which case that's where we connect to move that as a separate policy, because this may point out that there are policies that need updating or creating in the county. Yes.
Okay.
That sounds good.
It's a good opportunity.
Legislative camp.
Yes, thanks. So to net that all out, I think what we should incorporate is really thinking about how you can do some data mining and some AI to actually do that. Because if you're getting all those emails, and that stuff's available today, to scour subjects in emails, just scanning it and then separating it into categories, and then you can do your retention that way. Instead of, an email saying, yes, that truck's ready, you don't have to keep that. But for one that says, yes, I approve of this budget item, you do have to keep that, right? And so there's ways to set up the AI to scan the email systems and go through it and, set that up as your retention policy, right? For whatever the state law requires us to keep, federal law, whatever, county mm-hmm. law, whatever we determine there, right? I mean, I think we should utilize those things, right?
Yeah.
Going forward, it makes no sense not to, because it's there, it's available, and
takes a lot of the manual.
Takes all of the
things. Yeah.
Well, it's only as smart as the data put into it. But, yeah.
And as a side effect, with the cloud-based and commodity-based services, that actually can potentially drive our costs down because we're not storing all this information for long periods of time.
And do you use hybrid cloud or strictly cloud?
We are hybrid. Good. So, good. Yeah.
Good to see you, Stone. Thanks. Chair Bartels kind of brought this up, but I want to kind of drive this point a little bit further. I guess broadly what I'm curious about is kind of what's the best outcome for where we are in the process now in terms of this conversation, because the document that we have, which by the way is a huge step forward, and I'm so excited to read through it and see a lot of the stuff in trust, but there are still, the example about referencing the New York State schedule, is a good one. There's also, there's like an example of a question on page 21, which I don't want to necessarily get into, but it is a comment that says, this should be enforced through mandated use of password management utilities, and I don't see that like referenced in the document, or know that it's a comment that we should expect changes after.
Can you point out the section on that?
Yeah, it's section 2.10. On page 21. It's a comment, and this might just be
it would be addressed in the procedures of how we carry out the policy. So
right, but it's for us to provide, I guess I'm asking how do we support this process for where we are this week when there are comments that might be addressed in other areas. I don't want to get us going down a rabbit hole on things that aren't under the purview of this document, but I also want us to ask questions. The most concerning one, although I haven't maybe found all of them, but there's one on page 13 where there's a strike through, and the most recent comment in the version that I'm looking at here says that we'll add strike through until county attorney can review, but leave this in draft until then.
Which section again?
That section, it's on page 13. I don't see section headings on that page.
Okay.
It might be an early section of the document that is
okay.
More...
Review. Yeah.
But that's I just want to make sure that we're reviewing something that has been reviewed by the county attorney, or that we are providing the type of feedback that's appropriate for the stage of draft that we're in.
I think it'd be helpful. I mean, these are a lot of these have been resolved. Like, we've gone through most of Don's comments and resolved them, unless we have to kick them to somebody else internally for review. But I still think we're at the stage where if we could, I don't know if it is, how many times do you guys want to meet in terms of, do you want to go section by section, or do we call out the section and ask for comments? I don't know what's most productive for you guys, but that's, I guess, the level of feedback that it seems like some of you want to give, right?
Well, I think we were joking. Well, at least I was joking. I don't know about Brian.
I was joking, too.
Yeah, okay.
Well, we want to collect comments.
Yeah, and I will say, so that was going to be sort of direction I was looking to go is that I'm hoping everybody in this committee has read through this and have made their own notes, similar like Chair Bartels just did, and I have several notes throughout the document here that I want to go through as today. We don't need to go section by section or even line by line, but those who have comments should present them here now and then come back with a draft, another revised draft, and we'll go through it again. And then there's
that works. And then if there's some kind of conflicting comment with something that we haven't yet resolved from our consultant, then it's just more information that we have to take back and redraft and ask more questions and work with Sedera or county attorney or whoever it is.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't want to gloss over what the Chiuso said, but has this been reviewed by the county attorney?
The whole thing? No.
No. Okay. Which I think that section, again, there's some sections here for like how when you're looking at information, like what are there any legal ramifications to any of the this that should be vetted through the county attorney, which I think he left it in place that he
So for this comment specifically, the difference was between if we as a county want to separate confidential versus sensitive information. So is there like that kind of extra level of like legally this isn't considered confidential under like 42 CFR or PHI regulations, but we still consider it sensitive, or we want to just treat it all as confidential? And so for the time being, we left it in as sensitive so that we're still keeping that like level of caution. But Clint may say to just roll it together and treat it all as confidential information. So that's why it's still in there, but we haven't had him make that decision yet. But either way, the information will still be, you know, treated very carefully. That, of all the comments, is the only one that hasn't been resolved. All the other ones that are in there have been incorporated into the policy.
Okay. Sorry, everybody, this is Victoria Reed. If you guys haven't met her, Victoria has been she's in innovation, budget and innovation, and she has worked extensively on this document and trimming it by about 50 pages.
Nice to meet you. Good job.
Yeah.
So my question is a bit of a two-parter. It has to do with the roles and responsibilities. So here it's saying that all employees and users are responsible for complying with policy requirements, right? That's clear. But with this change, that's going to change training, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to know how deep a dive are you doing with training when you're talking to people about policies in the document? You're not going to make them read a 46-page document or 50-page document. How does every employee say, yes, I understand all the policies and I will actually comply with them?
Go
for it.
So one of the things that we've been talking about in general is how we are doing those trainings and making sure, and so this extends past obviously the IS policy to other things. And so within the standard operating procedures, that would lay out how we enforce the policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been talking about how we make a training module that can be done within the first week of employment as the orientation process to make sure that it goes through all the highlights of not just understanding the policy and where to access the policy, but also how to follow the policy, because for the staff, the procedures are going to be more important because the technology might change over time. And then with that system, we can track who's done it, so we know if people are out of compliance and we can follow up with them.
Great.
So we have a system called KnowBefore, which is a countywide training system where we can create videos that can be updated over time, and then they can access
people
it.
Have to kind of click through it.
Yeah.
And you can create training programs that are based on pre-canned modules that are kind of industry standards.
Okay.
Plus, we can add custom material that's really county specific that allows us to create a whole training package for either a new employee that they have to take within a certain period of time, and if they don't meet it, then we have the option of cutting off their access as an example, and then we could also have refresher courses too that make sure that people are still are adhering to the
one thing I want to bring up that is important is the timing of this training specifically, since it is so critical to accessing systems. We're not going to go, it's going to be part of orientation if you're a new employee, because if you're going to access our systems, you should know what you're obligated to.
And then the second part of that is it's sort of a bigger global question that has to do with county email addresses. And are we ever going to get to the point where we actually just require everybody to use a county email address rather than personal email address?
It's only us.
That's what I'm talking about.
Sounds like a policy discussion.
Do you want us to policy you? Are you offering?
I've been trying that for 20 years.
I'm just bringing it up because it drives me crazy.
Me too.
Personally.
I think everyone here uses their county email.
So. Yeah, it's
I think you're good in this room.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to get people who are elected to follow rules. You know,
to use the county systems, you are required to use a county email.
Correct.
Yeah, you have to go through a VPN and through your email.
I mean, you deal with other counties all the time. Are there set rules that all legislators have to use county emails?
No. I'm not aware of that. Any such standard? No.
I did a poll some time ago, and the answer is no.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Some of them don't use email at all.
So interesting.
You want to know how you scare some of them into using the county email? Explain to them that their personal email is now foilable.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
If they're using that as a means of communication, now if they're copied on it and it's being sent to them, that's not the same thing because you're also saying to the county. But if they're actually responding from or directing from their personal,
right,
their personal email is foilable. Same as your personal cell phones are actually foilable.
Yeah.
People don't realize these things.
There are several legislators who I'm using their work email, not county email, but work email.
Their work would probably not be pleased with those.
I'm going to bring this up next session because it's driven me crazy.
We bring it up every session.
I'm sure. Well, I'll do it again.
Yeah.
You could always do a FOIL training and scare everyone into understanding.
No, that's
a really good idea.
And that is something that we'll hopefully get into the system as well.
Yeah. So on the training, so aside from like your generic, you know, standard industry standard stuff, and then the county specific, will also be like some departments are going to have a much higher level of security required than other departments. Will it be department level training? You know, and I don't want to say canned training, but you know, specific to the requirements of that department.
A lot of that ends up happening through the corporate compliance plan and committee, which is run by Bonadio, and that is specific to your PHI. The rules regarding that.
Protected health information.
Oh, okay. So those departments are dealing with all that, I guess, specific types of protected information more than others who never deal with it, like tourism or OED. I know that it's addressed partially through there. Do you mean like through this policy, are we going to create tailored training on how they deal with this specific?
Not necessarily through the policy, but when you're doing the actual training, right? When you say you've got a week to learn this, you know, otherwise you're going to revoke your access, will there be the PHI requirement, will that be part of that training as well?
I think that's a conversation with Tom Gibney as our corporate compliance officer about how one would affect the other.
But we have, as part of the Know Before training platform, we have a compliance module, right? Which is available to every county employee, and has a series of compliance types of topics, which could be rolled out to all county employees. It could be targeted specific.
I would note too that the asset of the Know Before training is that we can put almost anything into it. Mm-hmm. So if you look at departments like the Department of Mental Health, a lot of times 42 CFR, which is substance use and mental health related information, will be a lot stricter than like personal health information or PII, which is why if you go to the doctor and you sign a record for your release, you have to check extra boxes for your mental health. Mm-hmm. So those departments, because they're state and federally funded, will have annual requirements for their staff to have extra trainings based on their grants. So it would be hard for us to make like a set grant that applied to the whole department that might not fulfill their funding requirements, but we could work with them to develop their own trainings that meet their requirements and have it in the Know Before platform so that anyone in the organization could access it while still meeting their needs.
I mean, it sounds like there's a pretty good handle on that already. Mm-hmm.
Through the corporate compliance plan, we're required to. So I'm just wondering, but it does... I've never overseen those departments directly, so I don't know how they train the individual caseworkers or SWEs or whoever else is doing that hands-on work and how they are supposed to handle the information that they possess. So I think it's worth an inquiry either way to see what's currently happening.
Thank you.
Well, that actually sort of ties into what I was going to bring up. Thank you, Brian, for doing that, because has every department been involved in this policy?
No.
Okay, so I think they should, because so even within the health information world, there are different levels of access and release. Mental health is additionally protected above normal health information, so is HIV status, there's some other STI-related information that's also additionally protected. Having I don't know that every person in that department does or mm-hmm. even should have access to those things. So that's more where the individual department should know their own world and know what, you know, to Brian's point, having specifically drilled down that these are individuals, not everybody needs to know about the requirements for accessing and releasing of that information throughout the whole county, but certainly within the health department and, you know, public health, there's going to be people who have access to that who need to know how much extra careful they need to be because there's additional requirement.
Right. I think probably a good pass at that then, because he's the county security officer on our corporate compliance committee, but taking that taking this policy up with that group is probably a good idea to the chair's point.
No, agreed, yeah.
So Tom Gibney, who works in health, Clint's on it, he's our privacy officer, so yeah, I think running it through that filter is a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
Yeah.
They canceled today.
Yeah.
So, okay.
And then a lot of, like, the case management systems we use, too, are, like, ones that the state, makes their departments use, so they'll already have those roles regulated and kind of trained as they onboard people to use them in the departments.
Yeah, and in terms of, you know, retention policy, again, there is going to be many different levels of different information that's going to be retained for different periods of time. Births and deaths are forever. You maintain those. General health information is now 10 years. There's others. Any litigation is statute of limitations plus the appeals time. The clerk's office, I think, the county clerk's office, would also have, you know, mm-hmm. information on this. I think we need to look at it. The other part, which I don't know if is still a requirement or law, it was several years ago, is any information that you maintain, you must also have the ability to read and duplicate that information. So we don't want to keep it forever for another reason of now you have to have equipment to go back to beta or max or whatever way you stored information, microfilm and all that other stuff. If you store it, you have to be able to read it and duplicate it. I don't know if that's still a requirement. It certainly was 15-plus years ago. That was a requirement that you, if you have the information, you have to have it readable and have a way to duplicate it. Okay. Do people have more?
You just had a quick question about this executive summary. So, is this part of what we're sending out to do all legislative have access to this executive summary?
I think that's fine. It gives them a roadmap into what's contained.
It's basically meant to be the first two pages of the document.
Yeah. Okay. I just think that obviously we're not going to read this, so it'd be nice to have something that's short and sweet that people can actually say I've read the executive summary.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
If it wasn't, then just have it all legislated. Is anybody else? All right, then if not, then I'll go through just sort of the comments that I had. Page 8 under the governance section.
You have a number?
There's no number. It's governance.
So
the numbers are in the section.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I would just ask you to consider having compliance as part of the steering committee. I don't see any mention of compliance in there.
Okay.
Page 10, under the enforcement and violation handling, sort of the last paragraph there, UCIS director is authorized instituting necessary measures, blah, blah, blah. I would just add in something that they must require to notify the county executive office. Not that you wouldn't, you specifically, but you also don't know who's going to be in this role in 5, 10, 20 years from now.
Fair.
You want to have it where they're required to notify if they're doing something to mitigate a situation that they actually let somebody else know that they're doing it.
Yeah.
One on page 10 as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
Exceptions to the policy. I'm sure this is in the form, which I would love to see, and I know that it's, you know, referenced to something later, but... even here, I think it should say that any exception to the policy is going to be time limited. I know the form would probably make that clear, but I think it should be very clear to any reader of this that were they to make a request, it would be very, very time limited.
Okay. That's fair.
Page 11, under county departments. This is just a general statement. I wrote here, employees required to report known or suspected fraud, suspected, okay, I'm missing a word there, but suspected fraud, waste, abuse, or vulnerabilities.
Okay.
Page 13, under confidential, it talks about HIPAA, but are we, I assume we are, but maybe I shouldn't, are we covered under, there's a term for the banking one, I don't remember what it is, and then
PCI?
You got, that may be it, and education is FERPA. There's no mention of those. Does that apply to the county?
We'll take a look at it. We should.
Okay.
We'll include the note and research that.
And I don't know if it's mentioned here, but also PII, personally identifiable information in general, could be in lots of different formats, and it could be like consumed by a lower, like it could be in the context of a lower, like it could be like a public use classified document could end up. Like something that typically would be classified that way could have PII in it that you wouldn't want to be available. Mm-hmm. Although some PII is like totally forced to be public.
But other things like taxpayer information, specific to who, what they pay or who their
yeah.
occupancy tax, for instance, is not disclosable.
Right, so they say. on this topic, I think it would be helpful, even if it's not relevant, to specifically say that foilable information is not, like, that, like your litmus test for something is foilable is irrelevant here. Unless it is relevant here, unless it's like public use is typically foilable information, because this is a document that's going to be consumed by people that might have also done FOIL trainings, and they might fall into the pattern of saying, oh, public. If it's foilable, it must be public use. That's my classification. And they might use that as a litmus test. Either it is relevant in deciding what classification it is, or it isn't relevant, and we should say, it's not relevant, don't be confused that it is.
Okay.
Page 19, 2.7, media protection. I didn't see any mention anywhere here, and I think it should be noted, things like Google Drive and Dropbox that we prohibit the use of those.
We do try as best we can to prohibit Google Drive. There's some special use cases where there's certain, some special use cases. Dropbox for business we use, we have an account with them, so we have managed access to that.
That's fine. I'm saying general staff.
Right.
Not using that.
They shouldn't all be creating their own personal.
Correct.
Right. So
cloud.
Call it out specifically.
Call it out. Yeah,
yeah.
Because
so
it could proliferate.
Doesn't it say information systems and devices shall not be connected to Gilsland County network infrastructure unless accredited and approved by CIS? Does that cover that?
It's not a device.
It's just another cloud
system.
Drive.
Or it could be
it's
a service.
I think we should call out specifically for the lay person.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the only reason I even flag that is because, unfortunately, we experienced that at the hospital where somebody was sending their stuff home because they couldn't put in a flash drive anymore years ago. And
so
because they couldn't do that, their workaround was send everything to their Google Drive, their personal.
Mm-hmm. And it also makes it clear that you're not supposed to be taking county information and putting an unapproved device or drive
or
system
service.
Or service, whatever it is. Yeah.
Well, and I'll just add, a lot of these services, especially when they involve receiving data, not necessarily storing it or creating it, but receiving it, someone can receive a Google Drive link. All of these platforms are incredibly aggressive with trying to make you sign up for an account. So you could end up, if you use your county email and let's say someone sends you a link on Box or Dropbox, it's going to try and create an account for that email address, and that account's going to live on forever, and that might end up staying authenticated in your browser, and then you access something else, and it gets uploaded into that account, and all of a sudden you have a county asset, which is the email address that now has this sub asset, which is a Dropbox account that was like you never realized you signed up for.
Mm-hmm.
So I think anywhere where we're referencing floppy disk, removable disk, CD, flash drives, we should also mention those
cloud services
like
storage
that. Right?
Services.
Yep.
Storage services or anything like that, right? Just make it a little bit cleaner.
I have something that we passed already. I don't know if you want to go in order or you want to just go through all yours and
roll back.
Go back.
I don't think there's many more, so let me just go through mine.
Okay.
Well, we're still on that.
I have something on. Oh, wait, never mind.
Oh, 3.8. there, but maybe it is a positive. Remote wiping of devices. We have that capability, and do we notify our people who are using that we can do that?
We can do that on mobile devices, and certainly mobile devices. I don't know if we have that feature on our laptops, but your point is that we should mention that we can remotely wipe assets.
Yeah.
Hmm. What section is that in?
3.8.
That's passwords and passphrases.
Yeah. 3.9, screen saver usage. This is more my healthcare hat on here, but immediate upon walk away. I think it should be required that you don't have a 2-minute, 5-minute timeout, because you can easily walk up to somebody else's computer and, you know, get on there. They should be required to Windows L and lock your computer upon walk away.
I agree strongly.
So no timer?
No, yes, timer and manual. It's kind of like the analogy that I would use is like these new body cams that we're buying for the sheriff's office turn on automatically, but it's still department procedure to turn it on yourself,
right?
Same thing.
So then that's also in the actual procedure document that the staff get trained on, is that workstations should never be left unattended. Probably because I came from the same scared by the hospital setting, but I've never unattended.
I think it's important to give people, like, it's unrealistic to assume that they'll never be left unattended. I think it's important to give people the pathway.
Yeah. I mean, it's Windows key L. It's simple, two little buttons.
Yeah.
Your computer's locked. It's pretty simple.
Everyone has the claw ready to go. You just push the buttons.
3.14 wireless communications. I think this is just more of a question I have, but do we monitor and log connected devices?
Yes.
Okay, so even devices on the public Wi-Fi here?
Any of the Wi-Fis that we manage, both public and internal, are monitored, and we track devices that are attached to them.
Okay, so do we monitor it proactively, or are we reactive with it?
We're reactive. Unless we see what are considered rogue devices. So if someone, and you see that periodically, like if somebody has a, like we have wireless Verizon
MiFi's,
right? Those might join our network and they broadcast as a rogue device. So we see things like that when someone's trying to connect. So we see things like that that the Wi-Fi dashboard deems as rogue, but generally speaking, we're not proactively monitoring whether or not a person's laptop is connected or which access point they're connected to. We will see our firewalls and our intrusion detection systems and our various logging devices that are collecting all of that log information will detect suspicious activity on any network, whether it's a hardwired network or wireless network, or public wireless network that we manage.
Do we monitor data usage spikes or large amounts of use on single devices?
We don't proactively monitor them, but we can go back and we can see retroactively all traffic.
So this is, so your monitoring software does not have the ability to set a limit?
We can, we're not doing that. Right?
Okay.
We're not doing that.
All right.
That's a really good point. I've been flagged at IBM a couple times for accidentally checking out way more files than I meant to from a library, and then putting them right back in. My manager's on the phone. What are you doing?
Yours is sort of legitimate. The one I'm referring to is an incident where staff is watching YouTube all night long connected to the free Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Mm.
And I say all night long.
Is there a problem share?
Yeah. It's no longer a problem because we now monitor it at the hospital, but this was one of those things that lessons learned that the staff was going on the free Wi-Fi network with their phones and watching 2-hour movies in the middle of the night.
Somebody sits on my wife's desk at work at the college every night.
Yeah.
Every night.
I have a question on the mobile devices. So, for employee-owned devices, like if they were to, like we all have Outlook, I have Outlook on my phone, right? So how are we, like what's the policy there? And I realize I can go in a lot of different directions and be very intense, and I'm not suggesting one direction over another, but I'm just kind of curious how the BYOD thing jibes with the encryption standard here.
So it's a good question. It's a hard one to kind of get your arms around. I mean, the iOS devices are, you know, have built-in encryption, so that by default is pretty secure, and I feel confident about that. As far as provisioning, are you talking about employees using their personal devices for things like Outlook and other, their kind of, is there any concern on my part?
Well, I guess I'm you know, in my mind, an acceptable answer would include, we don't have any, there's no way to access Outlook or any other county system on a device that doesn't, you know, that isn't from a manufacturer that uses encryption, and Android and iOS are all available only on encrypted hardware, and so that's fine.
I don't have an answer for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what devices are you aware of that are non-encrypted that would be able to have an Outlook app on it, a certified Outlook app?
I'm not. I don't know a lot about the Android ecosystem. Like if you could download the Android OS onto hardware that you bought in China.
Some jailbroke type.
Jailbroke thing that wasn't. Rooted. Yeah, exactly. Like could you then go into the Android App Store and download Outlook onto a piece of hardware that doesn't have encryption?
Not in the way you're saying it, but sort of. Rooted, it's what the jailbreaking is a different thing, but a rooted device, you could download softwares that have not been vetted, that are not on the Play Store or on whatever the Apple Store is or whatever it is. And an Android, you typically have to go to the Play Store. You can download a APK file if you have a rooted device, which means it's now that has not been pre-screened by Google or Android or whatever to make sure that it's free and clear of known problems. So these are like alpha and beta version softwares that could be on your phone at the same time as you have legitimate apps like Outlook.
Right.
Very few people in this world have rooted devices. It is not an easy process to do, and there's a high failure rate of doing it, and you essentially have a $1,000 piece of garbage because you can't do anything with it if you do it wrong.
Well, it used to be more popular, right?
That was jailbreaking. So you can go to different networks and things like that.
Yeah.
But rooting gives you the ability to get rid of the roadblocks that come pre-installed, and you can pretty much do whatever you want with your phone at that point.
Right, and the concern there would be adjacent software, not necessarily like the hardware or our software, rather, our you know, App Store downloaded, you know, tenant, our tenant being accessed by an App Store downloaded approved thing, but it's the thing that's next to it, like the other software that's on that phone compromising that phone. That would be the concern there, right?
Well, I don't see how, compromising the phone specifically, right? You're not talking about injecting or accessing county resources in Office 365. Or are you talking both?
Well, I'm thinking more like if you were, I mean, this might be a doomsday scenario, but like if someone had done something to their phone, let's say they rooted it and downloaded some sketchy thing, and then that sketchy thing was taking screen recordings and they were browsing through as their job, you know, as part of their job in whatever department they had access to critical systems or they had, I mean, I imagine someone with access to critical systems probably would have a county-issued device, I would hope, and they would only access it that way. But, like, let's say there's personal health information, and that person has been tagged, maybe by the person who gave them that phone or helped them download it, as someone that has access to information, and then that phone is going to start recording that information as the person brings it up on their screen as part of their daily work duties. I mean, it's like a weird doomsday thing with not a big payoff for the person who implemented it. But like, that's the kind of thing I'm thinking about.
Right. I mean, forensically, I can't see how you detect that. You know, we have systems in place that can monitor for command and control. So if a device has been compromised and is phoning home to some, you know, device somewhere out in Germany or anywhere for that matter that is not part of our county network, we know about it. We see this frequently because even if you go to a website that has a ad that's then started, it downloads a little applet that then is sort of broadcasting, you know, adware. As far as that system is concerned, that's command and control. So we see those things and we get alerts frequently on those things and we chase them down and we make sure that they're, you know, that typically 9 times out of 10, it's a phone, right? It's a And but again, we know that they're happening. We see these alerts. We get them in real time.
You get them from an endpoint software?
We get them from an endpoint software, yeah.
But like, so a BYOD situation wouldn't have endpoint software that you have access to.
Well, let's put it another way. So every network packet that traverses our the county is being logged, and it's being sent to a security operations center in Manhattan. That's part of the Joint Security Operations Center that was rolled out by the governor, and which is so that on top of a logging aggregator that logs all network traffic, again, it gets homed to a security operations center in another security operations center, which is part of Sedera in Buffalo. So we're seeing lots of information, lots of alerts. We got a series of teams behind us at our security operations centers that alert us when things unusual happen, and we go and investigate. And we take that device off the network, we scan it. 9 times out of 10, it's fucking adware that just reported as being suspicious. We clear it, we put it back on the network. And we also have the opportunities to, we have a sandbox in UCIS that we could take the device, put it on the sandbox, and explode and see what happens. So I don't know if that helps answer the question, but a lot of, we get a lot of forensic data coming in from multiple sources, both from the device itself, that's CrowdStrike, and the network itself, which is again the firewall switches, the routers, even the servers themselves are broadcasting messages to this aggregator that then we set up forensic monitoring on.
Chairman Dunn.
Yeah, so I looked at it, and I have more work to do, and I don't know if you looked at it against that Eisner-Ampner report, but on page 14, management policies, security assessment and authorization. So one of the things that Eisner-Ampner recommended was that that management include a matrix in the policy that defines the systems and data by category and identifies by title appropriate individuals to ensure a clear expectation for IT to follow when access is requested. Like, I noticed just that the language, and I guess this is that intersection of procedure and policy, but the language is so loose of leadership and a whole bunch of examples as deemed appropriate. So I don't know if you want to look at this against that assessment. It was a red line risk assessment of theirs.
Okay.
So, and there weren't many of them.
Yeah, I do.
There weren't many of them, the red ones, but that one jumped for me. And then the other thing that, and I don't know if I'm just missing it, but the other thing that they spoke at length was security breach procedures and protocols, including roles and responsibilities. I mean, in here, there's a section that has to do with mitigation, but am I missing, like, what? Where's the section that says, what do you do when the
okay,
blind
we have
hits
an incident
blind.
Response plan.
Okay, that's
cyber,
a separate...
That's separate, right?
Okay.
It's an incident response plan. We develop the incident response plan as a after action from a desktop exercise we did with FEMA and our internal Department of Emergency Services. And we have a cyber incident response plan that spells out how we react, how we detect and react to different types of cyber events. Mm-hmm. This is really, yep. It was very, it's part of the compliance plan. We need to have an incident response plan for us to pass our compliance audit. And in that, it addresses things like the New York Shield Act and other types of state mandated reporting mechanisms. So I could certainly forward it to you.
That would be great.
It is, again, it's a living document because it gives us the ability to kind of tweak the document as different types of risks emerge.
Does it lay out specific roles and
yes.
responsibilities?
Yes.
Okay.
Like
yeah.
Reporting chain.
And who should be in the mix and when you should call law enforcement, when you should call the.
And county. How often is that? Is there a? Is there an automated mechanism for reviewing and updating that, or is that something that just happens ad hoc? because I think that might be something you want to consider, that it something like that.
Minimum annually. In terms of language, I would say yes, we should include that type of language, but it does happen upon incident too, where
so
you say, what did we miss, or did the systems work, and did the reporting work as designed?
So I would suggest considering a minimum annually, or, you know, and upon reported incidents, you know, that you do both. But yes, I'd love to see it. Thank you.
Sure, yeah.
I have a question about social media. Do we have an inventory of all social media accounts that have been created in the county's name for any department, for all departments?
I don't know how recent it was. We did an inventory in 16-17, and at that time they were dispersed amongst the departments, and we ended up closing a lot of them and consolidating them and forcing people to primarily use the government, just the single Ulster County government one. I don't know. We've left select ones out there, whether it's the Transportation Planning Committee, because they're federally funded and required to have their own. Health has their, like, Healthy Ulster has their own.
Tourism.
I believe that, does tourism? I don't think they do anymore. Veterans has a group, but they don't have a page anymore. So there's selected ones, but I don't know if, I don't know the last time the inventory was done. I know it's been controlled, and we've tried to stay away from too many.
Yeah.
If you want Ulster County information, you should go to one.
We've done a lot of communication around not starting new ones, and that any type of communication, like going forward, if it's new, has to go through our office.
We have a form and a process they have to go through in order to request posts and all of those.
Oh, good.
We have forms.
That's good.
It's got forms.
I really like
I just, I'm imagining two things. One, I'm imagining implementing the policy and making sure that it's rolled out to all platforms, even of those sort.
Mm-hmm.
And then two, if one of those were to ever be compromised, like tracking down the logins, making sure, like, that can be really complicated, not because it has access to a critical system, but because it's putting out misinformation.
And that has happened.
Yeah.
Like, just in terms of somebody leaves and they were the one that had access, and then it's almost, with some of the social media accounts, it's almost impossible to get it back. They make it extremely difficult.
Well, there's a new way to do it now, too, that, I don't know, you know, because we do it at the they did it at the hospital, is they, instead of giving someone a login to the actual page, it links accounts, and then you can control the access to it, and you can turn that person off, so you don't have one standard login that a person is leaving with.
Yeah, which is a great thing that the platforms have all done.
Mm-hmm.
So we should do it, we should run another inventory just to make sure that
you should probably go into those business manager accounts and run an inventory on the authorized users as well, because that's who's going to get compromised.
Mm-hmm. And just take everybody off Liddy.
No, I put that shit behind me 10 years ago. I used to have logins for this place, all right? And I think I all of that.
Flash.
On page 32, acceptable use, I just want to point out, you know, both conduct and acceptable use, section 4 says that Ulster County personnel regulations require that employees abide by applicable laws, regulations, and standards of conduct, blah, 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 blah. No disrespect intended with the blah, blah, blah. And then 4.1, general principles. Users of Ulster County systems are expected to abide by this acceptable use policy. But honestly, there's no acceptable use policy here. It doesn't say what acceptable use. It just references applicable laws, regulations, and standards of conduct in a very generic way. I don't know if we want to be more...
Honestly, I think it's a typo. I think it's supposed to say acceptable use procedures. I think it's supposed to say abide by acceptable use procedures. I think I just missed it when I was cutting.
Where? In the second?
In that 4.1, that sentence, I think I just missed it when I was cutting. I think it's supposed to say are expected to abide by acceptable use procedures as well as other.
I just think that we need to be more maybe prescriptive about what is acceptable use. Like, this is the place to have it. And that kind of goes back to social media, et cetera. It's like, I would just encourage you to be a little more firm here, because it's almost like a circular thinking, like it's saying there are standards, you have to abide by these standards, or there are procedures, you have to abide by these procedures, but it doesn't actually say what the procedures are. And there are certainly some things we can agree upon, like watching YouTube all day. So there's some things that we could say, you're not supposed
including,
to
use your device, including but not limited to watching
this.
YouTube all day while you're at work.
And I can, yeah. So I just let's try to make it a little.
I think
tighter.
It's defining the business purpose for which you have access.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there is prohibited. I was going to say, you know, maybe we just reference the, you know, what's contained in the document, because there are real specific things that say you can't do this, you can't do that, you shouldn't do this.
Yeah.
Sometimes
which
it's also good to also just inject what you should be using it for specifically, instead of just all here's the million things you can't do.
Right.
This is actually
right.
the purpose you were given access for.
I mean, this does, you know, reserve the right to seek legal action and terminate people.
Yeah.
So again, I think even just. If I'm referencing this document for acceptable use really quickly, it would help if, and it, you can do it in either way. You can do it in the positive or the negative, but
okay.
I would just maybe be.
I'm feeling positive today, Tracy.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was what you had. You had your hand up.
That's just my.
Okay.
You know, just saying that it does, it's in many places within the document, it does outline really very specifically what you should and shouldn't do.
Yeah, but I think Tracy's point is that it's kind of a cop-out that that is referenced to the section.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I think that's legit, right? So put it in there, you know, as outlined in this policy or as prescribed in this policy or something like that, right?
I do just want to also reiterate, and again, I'll do a little more work against Eisner Ampler just to make sure I know you have it, but just want to also, I know it was said earlier, but thank you for doing the work that it took to give us something like we're actually really discussing a real policy now, which is super exciting. It's a long time coming.
24 years.
It's a long time coming. Yeah, I know you're excited, but it's, you know, there's a lot of necessary good in here. So, you know, we can do some tightening, but we're on a path, which is exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if I may, like, we'll run through your comments. We'll continue the internal review. We're going to run this through corporate compliance. And then maybe it's a testing with some of our department heads that are going to have probably more involvement with this.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's up, like, is this another, this is probably another special meeting similar to this. But we'll make sure that when we circulate the document, we'll do drop dead. We'll stop making any edits, so you guys have at least a week to review, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then if there's other comments you want to submit during that time, I would, you know, I don't know, like, if we want to do in 30 days another review, is that reasonable for you guys as well? Like, for us to do our internals, we'll have one corporate compliance meeting within that time period. If you guys could give us, like, within the next 2 weeks, give us your comments.
Well, that's what I was going to suggest, is, like, give you at least, you know, a week, if not more, to incorporate what we're suggesting. And then, you know, we got to, at some point, we got to stop and say, you know, we're good here, right?
My estimation is based on the work that we've already done, what has to be done. We're going to have another special,
and
then
that'll
probably
that
move us
it.
To near finalization with passage November.
Yeah.
Just based on the current schedule, I think that's...
Or October, possibly. I mean, it's like with your 30 days, it puts us, if we're on the same timeline, we're...
Because the resolution's already out there. So
yeah, the resolution's already
out.
We're ahead of the October meeting. I mean, that could be... I think Legislator Cahill's point is well taken. You know, we want to get it to the best place possible, but this is eons past where we are currently, right?
Right.
So it's like we'll get it to the point of passage, and then... It can be amended.
Yeah, of course.
Right. So, like, but let's just let's get it as solid as possible. But I think we're looking at next month.
A lot of good work. This is an ever evolving, complex problem that is just going to just keep being that way forever, right? So
I mean, in many ways, we kind of already operate in some of these from a philosophical perspective, but it's nice to have it in a documented.
Right.
It's critical. Yeah.
It's
actually
critical,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
You know,
business continuity.
And it gives everybody kind of the rules of engagement, you know, so that we know collectively what we're, you know, how we operate. You know?
That's right.
Which is,
No, it's okay.
That's what I was just going to say, which is why I think, like in that acceptable use policy, like a pass looking through how individual header sections would be read as individual sections, just looking at it from that viewpoint one time, I think would be helpful. Okay. Just to say, does this section contain what it actually needs to contain as a standalone, especially if it's a headline section, right?
I have a question and then a follow-up to it. The Ulster County Technology Steering Committee and the Ulster County Information Technology Security Group, are those formed currently, or will they be formed?
They are formed.
Yeah, we meet on a weekly basis on the one,
okay,
and as warrants on the other. So the
cool. I was just like, I was thinking about that, and I'll still say my comment, but I'm really happy to hear that. You know, I would suggest as we approach implementing, like adopting this, and you're probably already doing this, but I'll just emphasize how important it is to start getting buy-in from stakeholders that will help implement this and roll this out from an organization's change perspective. When you get folks, and you know, even if it's not material changes and suggestions that they provide, but to give them a sense of ownership and involvement in this before it's finalized will help create an environment where the rollout is more, benefits from people feeling a sense of ownership over it.
Yeah.
So the more, you know, as you work your way down from those that are, you know, becoming the champions of our policy, getting them that buy-in now, developing that champion mindset is a huge organizational change opportunity.
Great. Great idea.
I'll make a motion.
Second. Discussion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Aye.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you,
everyone. Thank you.
Look at that, man.